How soon is now? Today on the world. I'm Marco Werman. Some intelligence experts say the North Koreans have miniaturized a nuclear weapon. But when it comes to Pyongyang, it's all a guessing game.
Are we years, are we months away from functional weaponization? And the answer is no one really knows, for sure. No one outside Pyongyang.
Plus, a Native American tribe that straddles the U.S.-Mexico border fears being split, literally, by Trump's wall.
We've been here for time immemorial. We've been here forever. And yet, the federal government and others are still trying to take things away from us.
And the shop in L.A. where Iranians can find a few surprises.
This is totally just blow your mind because you can find the most illegal books in the bookshelves here.
It's all coming up today on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. Glad you could be here on this Thursday. Okay, I don't mean to be alarmist, but a week ago, few of us were contemplating the possibility of a war with North Korea. Not seriously. Now, after all the hostile rhetoric from both Pyongyang and Washington, it's not far-fetched to wonder what would happen if a conflict really does break out.
If our response on the North Korean nuclear program is nuclear weapons, the fallout pattern puts that fallout over Japan.
I can't believe we're even talking about this. More on the possible military scenarios later on the show. First, like I said, I'm not an alarmist, so let's start with a reality check. There are intelligence reports that North Korea has miniaturized a nuclear warhead so it can fit inside one of its missiles. I asked John Schindler how credible that information is. He's a former NSA analyst and counterintelligence officer, now a national security columnist for The Observer.
The U.S. intelligence community is not completely behind this assessment, but the DIA report is broadly agreed with by a lot of intelligence agencies, including a report out of Japan. So I don't think this can be dismissed out of hand. But you have to remember that the Defense Intelligence Agency is one of the lower rungs of our intelligence community. This does not carry the weight of a CIA assessment, for instance, which has greater prestige, generally better analysis. So I think some caution is in order. It shouldn't be dismissed. But it is DIA, which has a pretty bad reputation in our intelligence community, frankly, for shoddy analysis. They were responsible for a lot of the debacle back in 2002 and 3 over Iraq WMD. So caution is probably wise.
You've described North Korea as a black hole for U.S. intelligence. What are the major difficulties getting intel out of Pyongyang?
Well, if I could break this down a little bit, the U.S. government, like all modern governments, gets intelligence from many sources. We have human spies, we have electronic intercepts, we have spy satellites taking pictures, the full gamut. And North Korea is really tricky for all of those, particularly because we don't have an embassy there. We don't have commercial relations with North Korea. So there aren't American business people, there aren't American diplomats, which means there aren't American spies. Electronic intercepts are difficult. The North Koreans are very aware of our capabilities and do what they can to fool us, to spoof us. And even taking pictures from satellites, which is safe, is no panacea. That's our biggest source of intelligence. But the North Koreans have capabilities in what spies call denial and deception, meaning that they know we're taking pictures and they go to some lengths to fool us.
Let's go back to the credibility of this intel, because you brought up the DIA and the war in Iraq and those reports that Saddam Hussein had weapons of mass destruction, which turned out to be false. How do we know there's not a similar situation going on here with this assessment?
Well, I think North Korea is much further along in the sense that we know from seismic watching that North Koreans since 2006 have detonated several nuclear weapons underground. So there's no real debate about that. The debate is simply about their capability of weaponizing it. I do want to make clear that, you know, Saddam Hussein wanted the world, especially Iran, by the way, to believe he had nuclear weapons because that was deterrent. It would regime survival. His denial and deception program convinced us more than Iran and really worked far too well. I don't think the North Koreans are in that boat exactly. This is a regime that's been doing this for a very long time. We know they have chemical weapons of some sophistication. If they are within even less than a year of miniaturizing a warhead to put on an ICBM or medium-range ballistic missile, I think that is a very serious problem.
John, you work for several intelligence agencies in the past. How do you evaluate an intelligence report about a potentially dangerous development like this? Like, were you skeptical of the WMD assessment in Iraq in 2002?
I was. I think a lot of people were very skeptical. The problem was the political pressure was on from the White House on down to find a certain answer. And I think we all have to be concerned this could be happening again, notwithstanding that obviously North Korea is much further down the nuclear road than Saddam's Iraq ever was. Look, you assess things with a seasoned eye. You know, an individual human intelligence report is not very persuasive. A single electronic intercept or two or three are not particularly persuasive. A handful of satellite images of a known or suspected nuclear missile, that's not in itself conclusive, but you put them all together over months and years, and this is where veteran analysis really matters, you do get a much clearer picture. And you have to understand North Korea, despite the incredible intelligence obstacles we face there, has obviously been one of the highest priorities for U.S. and Western intelligence for a very long time. So we do everything we can to find out what we call ground truth about what's going on there. Pyongyang obviously makes it very difficult for us.
That's John Schindler, a former NSA analyst and current national security columnist for The Observer. Now into how the U.S. might respond to North Korea's nuclear capabilities and its threats. North Korea has threatened to test fire missiles at the waters around Guam. So what options would the U.S. have in such a scenario? We put that question to Joshua Pollack. He's editor of the Non-Proliferation Review and previously consulted for the U.S. government on issues related to weapons of mass destruction.
Normally, there really are no opportunities to intercept test launches at all. This may be an unusual circumstance, though. The reason you normally can't intercept a test is most countries test inside their own borders, and you can't position defensive assets there. In North Korea's case, they test out to sea, but we can't defend the oceans of the world. We have to focus our assets. In this instance, however, they have told us where they're going to shoot. They have told us that they are going to come within 30 or 40 kilometers of the shores of Guam, where a THAAD unit exists.
And what is the THAAD unit, just briefly?
That is a theater high altitude area defense system. In other words, it is a missile defense unit that covers about 200 kilometers in the direction that it's pointed. So anything coming from a certain direction that's anticipated, that comes into the defended area, is potentially interceptable. Furthermore, since the North Koreans have told us roughly when to expect this test, we can also position even more capable defensive assets in that area in the form of Aegis-capable destroyers, which have even more powerful interceptor missiles on them. I'm not saying that it's necessarily a good idea to do this if they simply are going to kill some fish. Maybe you just let them. But it strikes me as something that the administration will probably consider.
So as we just heard, North Korea is making advances on the offensive front. Has the U.S. kept up on the defensive front?
Well, we're trying. Both THAAD and Aegis have recently been tested for the first time against targets that simulate intermediate-range ballistic missiles like the ones that North Korea is threatening to fire into the vicinity of Guam. They have been engineered and updated and perform pretty well in tests. We can contrast that with the ground-based mid-course defense based mostly in Alaska, whose purpose is to intercept ICBMs aimed at North America. That has about roughly a 50-50 rate of success over the years. It has not been tested extensively and has had a very disappointing track record. Ultimately, our defense against nuclear attack is not defense at all, but deterrence. It is persuading an adversary with the prospect of retaliation that it is not a good idea to attack in the first place.
I got to say, it's really disturbing to see, you know, headlines about people thinking about World War III these days. Just help us understand what this moment means. I mean, how anxious are you?
I'm not happy, but I'm not too worried either. What this looks like to me is the beginning of a new mutual deterrence relationship. That was a very shaky process between the United States and the Soviet Union. It was relatively smooth with the United States and China because of the Chinese low-key approach to nuclear weapons. This is shaping up to be somewhere in between. I don't think we are headed for the Cuban Missile Crisis Part 2.
What would you advise the U.S. government to do right now?
I would advise them to talk to the North Koreans about setting up a hotline between the Department of Defense and their general staff of their military. It could take a variety of forms. I think this is simply what a responsible nuclear-armed state does to avoid its own destruction by accident. That is how the North Koreans portray themselves. So they should be willing to give it consideration. Whether either of the governments in question is interested right now, I don't know, but they ought to be.
Joshua Pollack, editor of the Non-Proliferation Review, thank you very much for your time.
You're welcome.
A year ago, the Summer Olympics were in full swing in Rio de Janeiro. The focus was mostly on the athletes, and the problems that plagued organizers ahead of the Games seemed forgotten. Now, 12 months later, it's clear that many of those problems are still there. For example, one of the legacies of the 2016 Olympics was supposed to be a safer city. Officials in Rio promised reforms to make that happen. Here's an update from reporter Catherine Osborne.
On Rio's one-year Olympic anniversary, thousands of federal troops patrol the streets. And they're going to be there for a while. Brazil's Ministry of Defense announced the troops are going to stay until the end of 2018. Their deployment is in response to criticism that security in Rio was out of control. This past June alone, 106 people died in gunfire in the city. Many were killed in shootouts between drug traffickers and police. That's Federal Security Minister Sergio Etchegoyen speaking last week. He said, quote, "We're at war. You can expect that undesirable things will happen, even some injustices." This is a major shift from the policing strategy launched before the Olympics, called pacification, which was supposed to de-escalate relations between police and poor communities.
I think it's a failure of public security in Rio, you know, as a whole.
Sociologist Julita Lim Gruber tracks police behavior and attitudes citywide at Cândido Mendes University. She says Rio police had a genuine opportunity to reform their ways as the city prepared to host the Olympics, but there's been no serious follow-through.
It's really a media show marked with cynicism and hypocrisy.
One example, she says, is the army's claim that it's now necessary to bring tanks to Rio to map the local terrain. She points out that local police forces have spent heavily on intelligence in recent years, spending that authorities defended in order to prepare Rio for the Olympics. Research by an Amnesty International initiative called Crossfire shows that it's Rio's favelas that are most affected by the security breakdown. Some neighborhoods experience daily shootouts that close schools and businesses. Tanaji Medeiros lives in the Alemão group of favelas. He says he's counted 197 days of shootouts through July. That's almost every day so far this year. And these are shootouts that kill both residents and police. Medeiros is part of a citizen journalism collective called Papo Reto, or Straight Talk, which denounces security failures in Alemão, with the help of smartphones and video streaming through Facebook Live. He plays me a video he recorded about a month ago when he woke up to go to work just as a gun battle was happening near his house. Upon reflection, he says, it's crazy that people were getting up to leave their houses and go to work during all this. His recording captured over 30 gunshots being fired in just 4 minutes. Last month, Medeiros helped launch a campaign called Favela Lives Matter, inspired by a partnership between Brazilian activists and American representatives of Black Lives Matter, who have now visited Rio twice.
Foi só a pressão popular que foi possível fazer melhorar isso.
He says the campaign is turning up popular pressure on the government over its failure to deliver security to its citizens. And that activism is slowly bringing results. Last month, political organizers from the Alemão favelas worked with a public prosecutor to force the police to stop invading resident homes to set up makeshift operating bases.
Com as Olimpíadas, os abusos aumentaram e a resistência aumentou também.
He says he's seen at least one welcome Olympic legacy, a stronger resistance, and new alliances between activists to push back against government failures. For The World, I'm Catherine Osborne in Rio de Janeiro.
Still ahead, blesser culture and how it's fueling the spread of HIV in South Africa. That's next here on The World.
What would the news sound like if media were diverse?
Things get racialized here. Muslim is this weird racial thing here, and I don't think our parents were prepared for that.
I'm Rupa Shenoy, host of the podcast Otherhood. Listen to What You're Missing on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. All this week, our Across Women's Lives team is reporting from South Africa, where the HIV epidemic rages on. Over 7 million adults are infected, and young women are twice as likely as men their age to get the virus. One of the reasons for that is what South Africans call blesser culture, young women having sexual relationships with older men in exchange for money and gifts. Here's the world's Jasmine Garis from our Women's Lives team in Johannesburg with more on that.
We have this occurrence of the thing called a blesser in South Africa.
Blessers at the it thing, you know.
This hashtag started being noticed on Instagram, and it was hashtag blessed.
You've got young women who, they want the nice things. So they look for what's called in this country a blesser.
So a blesser is kind of like a sugar daddy. It's a guy who's older, who has girlfriends who he lavishes with gifts in exchange for sex and companionship. And yeah, this kind of exists everywhere in the world. But here's what's different. 20% of the adult population in this country has HIV. New infections are mostly in girls and young women. And there's a lot of evidence that they're getting infected by older men. I decided to find out about this for myself. So how hard was it to find a blesser? Not hard at all.
When I bless you, you need to bless me back too.
This is Serge Kabangi. He's a local celebrity here. He flaunts the fact that he's a blesser on TV, newspapers, social media. He says he has 10 or 11 girlfriends at a time. And here he is on an episode of MTV South Africa.
I show you the kingdom. You understand? You need to show me the heaven too.
We reached out to Serge and he responded right away. He invited me to this exclusive, secluded hotel one night to talk.
Serge, nice to meet you.
He's a short, wiry man in his mid-40s. He shows up wearing jeans, a leather jacket, and gold-encrusted Versace running shoes. They cost him $1,500. I know that because he told me. In fact, throughout the night, he lists the price tag on a lot of things he owns. We sit at the bar and start talking.
I can't just go date any ugly girl. I need a hot girl.
Okay. I have to warn you. Throughout the rest of the night, Serge said some stuff about women that made me really uncomfortable.
I'm sure you understand when I use those words of hot. It means a girl who have a hips.
To his credit, Serge was really honest about who he is and what he expects from women.
Give me attention. Show me you are the person that I want.
And what he gives in return depends on the girl. He says there are different levels.
Level one is students. People are studying, this young one.
He buys the college students' cell phone data and gives them pocket money. Serge's levels go up to number 5. If you're a 5, you might get to go to Paris.
For you to reach that level, really, you need to do a lot on that level. You need to prove yourself.
So suppose you're a student and you really need that money. Or maybe you really like nice things you couldn't afford growing up. This guy comes along and offers it all to you. Are you really in a position to ask him to wear a condom? Serge says yes, and he tells me he gets tested for HIV often.
I do it a couple of times, I'm free, you know. I protect myself.
Listen, he tells me, I'm a really decent guy, and I'm being honest about what I want.
Amen. From Monday to Friday, he cannot be eating chicken from Monday to Friday.
Yes, he just referred to women as chicken. As he says this, one of his girlfriends is sitting right next to us, listening. Hao is 26. She asked that we don't use her last name. She tells me she met Serge a year ago at a bar.
A waiter came to me and said somebody wanted to buy me champagne. So it's like a glass of champagne, and then like, no, he actually says you can order as much as you want.
Rao is statuesque, gorgeous. When Serge steps away to chat with his friends, she and I get to talk a little.
Behind closed doors, we laugh, we dance, he cracks jokes. People don't believe that he does, but he does do that, you know.
I ask her how the financial arrangement works.
If I had to see something that I like right now, I would call him and say, hey, I'm at a certain place, please help me out. I have to buy certain things, makeup, whatever, please help me out. And he would.
Rao is soft-spoken, but she does want to clarify that she practices safe sex.
We have to use protection.
It's getting late, and Serge wants to go to a nightclub. You should come, he says, but we politely decline. Before we part ways, I ask Rao one last thing I'm curious about.
Are you in love?
Here's the thing, he makes me happy. I don't really know how to say I'm in love or what, but I do care a lot about him.
The blessee and the blesser, an older man showering a younger woman with gifts in exchange for sex, a trend that's widespread in South Africa. Jasmine Garz is with me to talk more about that story. So, Jasmine, how worried are the healthcare workers in South Africa by the whole blessing trend?
Quite worried, quite worried. I mean, there's ample evidence that the reason young girls are getting infected so much is because of older men. I spoke to sex therapist Marlene Wasserman.
These blessers are, you know, high risk men, because these are men who are probably married and they've got multiple partners. You know, young girls are young girls. And now today with social media, they want to be Kim Kardashian.
Wow, that's an interesting connection.
Yeah, I mean, there's definitely the idea that this comes from this conspicuous consumerist Western culture and is really fueled by social media. You know, you show off all the lavish gifts that this guy gives you.
I could hear in your story, Jasmine, that you struggled a lot with your feelings about this couple, Serge, and Hao.
I did. I did struggle with how I felt about it. I really liked Hao. She's smart. She's funny. She's really charismatic. And she seems like she's in control of this situation. It seems like they are two consenting adults who have an agreement and who are safe about it. And you know, I talked to an anthropology student about this. Her name is Lebo Masango, and she studies blesser culture. I asked her straight up, is this exploitation or is it women's empowerment?
They understand the risk of HIV. They understand the risk of multiple concurrent partnerships. But like there's this post-feminist sensibility that's beginning to be entrenched, especially in young women of the middle class, where they're choosing to do this even against all of the other, you know, stigmas that exist around it.
So, Jasmine, you've been working on this story for a while now. Did you kind of arrive at any kind of conclusion?
Sure. I think there's a bigger issue here than the relationship that Hao and Serge have. And I think the bigger issue is that there are thousands of girls in this country who are following this arrangement, and they're not in the same position as Hao and Serge. They are in a position in that they need the money. They need the money for books. They need the money for food. And that is not a position of power. It comes down to power. And if a guy is paying your bills, do you really have the power to say, listen, there's an epidemic out there. I need you to put on a condom?
Jasmine Garz, a reporter for our Across Women's Lives series. All this week, she's been bringing us stories from South Africa, from the front lines of the HIV epidemic. Jasmine, thanks for being with us today.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
I like words.
A podcast.
Fat, buttery words.
About language.
Sniggly, chuckling words.
The world in words.
Wormy, squirmy, mealy words.
The world in words.
Get it on Apple Podcasts.
Or wherever you subscribe to podcasts.
I'm Marco Werman. Author David Mitchell is best known for epic novels like Cloud Atlas. But his latest book is a translation of a young Japanese writer with autism.
You could ask him a question and he would be unable to answer it verbally in the same way that you would be unable to jump out of a window and fly.
More of that incredible story still ahead on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH here in Boston. So many questions remain about President Trump's big, beautiful wall along the U.S. border with Mexico, and not many answers. We know there's money in a recent House spending bill to build a wall in parts of the border that don't already have a barrier. And we know that former Homeland Security Secretary John Kelly, now the president's chief of staff, has said that wall will be placed where it makes sense and is effective. But that's about it. Combine that with all the questions around what will happen with trade and immigration policy, the uncertainty is beginning to cause chaos in areas closest to the border. The world's Roopa Shenoy, host of our Otherhood podcast, was just in southern Arizona. And Roopa, earlier you were telling me about some of the economic and cultural impacts you saw there. Let's just start with what you saw economically. What was obvious?
Okay, so on Friday nights in Tucson, the big thing for Latino families for several years has been to go to this outdoor market called the Tanque Verde Swap Meet. So you can hear there's games, rides, music, hundreds of vendors, and they sell everything from like appliances and mattresses to candy. It's been a great place for small businesses to get going, especially women-owned businesses. Mm. But I was there on a Friday night recently, and there were about a third of the normal amount of people there. I mentioned that to Jessica Morales. She sells boots for people who work on construction sites.
Now you only see American people walking around. They just watch. And Mexican people like me, we buy a lot. We eat a lot. We come here to buy our things.
Sounds kind of like a shame. It sounds like the kind of place, when we heard earlier, the place that I'd like to go on a Friday night. So why does she think people are staying away now?
But her first thing that she says is that the dollar to peso rate has made things expensive. And then she also says that they are saving money in case someone in the family gets deported. Mm. And then fewer workers are coming over the border to do things like day labor because they're afraid of being deported as well.
What happens if people just don't show up on Friday nights at this market? What if this continues?
She has a plan. She's going to sell online on places like Craigslist and eBay.
Is it just this market? What about big businesses?
Not yet, actually. We're not seeing the economy as a whole be disrupted yet. Mm. But I talked to the Tucson Hispanic Chamber of Commerce president, Leah Marquez Peterson, and she just says it's a matter of time.
It's business as usual because we have to do that. But yeah, uncertainty is not good for business.
Roopa, what about the wall? I mean, say what you will about the wall, but a big infrastructure project like that could create a lot of jobs in the region, or is the wall just too toxic a project for people to be a part of?
That's what it seems like. It's really, really controversial in southern Arizona to work on the wall.
You've got local municipalities stating resolutions that they don't support the idea or the concept of a border wall, and they're going to punish businesses that potentially may work on the border wall. I mean, so it's really just been very chaotic.
So a real economic dilemma. And Roopa, you also said this goes beyond economy to culture as well. How's the discussion over the wall changing culture? What did you see there?
The big example for me, it really struck me, was the Tohono O'odham. That means the desert people. They're an independent nation the size of Connecticut.
Wow. And,
yeah. And they have 75 miles of the border. And after 9/11, they agreed to put up a fence along their stretch of the border. And they allowed U.S. Border Patrol to come in and have a bigger presence. But now they're worried the U.S. will want a wall. And for them, that's a really big deal, a whole different ballgame, because a lot of their tribe members are on the other side in Mexico, because that was part of their nation before the U.S. and Mexico created their mutual border in the 1850s. And there's widespread fear now that the U.S. will force the wall on the nation. Giselle Ramon Sabrin is a PhD student at the University of Arizona and a tribe member who covers the Tohono O'odham as a reporter.
There's people that are just scared, because it's like, if this wall were to go through, then what else can President Trump take away from us? Is he going to take our sovereignty away? We've been here for time immemorial. We've been here forever. And yet the federal government and others are still trying to take things away from us.
So, Roopa, what does the U.S. government have to say about this?
So they're in regular communication with the Tohono O'odham. And there are no immediate plans for a wall along that section. But the nation would like more assurances. And Giselle and other younger tribe members told me they thought people like those who got behind Standing Rock would also get behind an effort to protect their nation. But Giselle also says that's not so much the Tohono O'odham way.
We just like to be quiet. We like to kind of stand in the back and not really say anything and keep things to ourselves.
She says that's their culture. But if they're going to stand up for themselves against the U.S. government, they'll have to change.
I mean, a wall, it's so much more consequential than just a barrier for humans, and construction hasn't even begun yet. Roopa Shenoy, thanks a lot for coming in and talking to us about what you saw down there.
Thank you.
Iran, as you may know, is one of the world's most censored countries, and that goes not just for news media and the internet, but for books, too. Many Iranians recall book burnings of forbidden writing in Tehran over the years. But a Persian bookstore in Los Angeles is fighting back. Valerie Hamilton has our story.
Poets are a big deal in Iran, and Farrukh Farrukhzad was one of the biggest.
In the 1960s, she was practically a rock star, known by her first name like Madonna. Here's a record she cut reading her poetry.
Oh, sahm man in ast, sahm man in ast, sahm man.
When she was killed in a car crash in 1967, thousands of fans thronged her funeral. But after the Islamic Revolution came to power in 1979, Farouk's books vanished. First banned, then censored by the government. Thousands of miles from Tehran in his bookstore in Los Angeles, Bijan Halili is trying to explain the logic of censorship to me with a racy line from one of Farouk's poems.
Life is perhaps lighting a cigarette in the languid moment between two love makings. That's enough to be banned.
Banned books are a specialty of Halili's. His store has a whole section for them, books on religion, histories of modern Iran. Here in the U.S., they're just books, but in Iran, they're contraband.
First of all, let me explain to American listeners that countries like Iranian that is under a dictatorship, you have to go and get the permission to publish.
Let's say you have a novel, the story of a kid wizard named Harry. Before the publisher rolls the presses, Iran's Ministry of Culture and Islamic Guidance gets to weigh in, with changes, cuts, or an outright ban.
For example, is somehow they think that is against Islam, then you cannot publish that book.
What qualifies as against Islam can be pretty broad. It includes criticizing the government, acknowledging the Holocaust, mentioning wine, even in a cookbook.
They had to change it to something else, like vinegar.
Sex, dancing, dictators meeting an untimely end. If these are major plot points, you'd better start rewriting. And yes, Iran censored Harry Potter.
This is the Ministry of Guidance. 1984. Orwell, yeah.
Orwell's 1984 is a book he knows well. Halili was a grad student in Iran at the time of the revolution, and he voted against the Islamic regime and landed in jail. When he fled the country, he stuffed a copy of 1984 into his suitcase, along with books by Dostoevsky, Victor Hugo, and the Persian poet Hafez.
I had nothing else to bring. I left everything behind.
That suitcase full of books made up the first shelf at Kitab, the first Persian bookstore in the United States. Today, the store's bigger, on a busy street in West L.A., home to a large Iranian exile community. But it still has that old-time feeling. Tall stacks of books on spirituality, sociology, politics, history. And between them, people reading whatever they want. It's quiet and quaint. And for Iranians raised with censorship, it's amazing.
This is totally just blow your mind because you do not expect such a thing to be here. You can find the most illegal books in the bookshelves here.
I meet Ali while he browses the business section. He recently moved here from Iran and asked me to use only his first name. He fears retaliation against his family back home. The crazy thing is, we're only talking about books. I ask him why they're so controversial.
So if you have more knowledge, then knowledge is the power.
Knowledge and power, two things Iran's censors try to control. But Iranian readers can find ways around the limits, with the help of exiles like Halili. Because Kitab isn't just a bookstore. It's also one of several Persian publishers outside Iran helping banned writers get their books out. Some of their books get smuggled into Iran, then shared or pirated for the black market. The internet helps, too. Iranians who can crack the government firewall can access uncensored e-books by Kitab and other publishers.
I'm proud that I helped some Iranian to be knowledgeable about whatever happened or whatever is close to truth.
Because the truth, he believes, could set Iran free.
If we being successful to break that ban and that censorship, I believe the Islamic regime era will be ended very soon.
Is that a goal of yours?
I hope so. Yes, of course.
Breaking censorship for good still feels a long way off. But Kitab books have reached at least one unexpected bookworm, Iran's government. Kitab books on taboo topics like gender equality and political prisoners have somehow, mysteriously, made it from Los Angeles to the collection of Iran's National Library. And who knows? Maybe someone is reading them. For The World, Valerie Hamilton, Los Angeles.
We began the show today with a reality check on North Korea. Now let's take a closer look at the military scenario should a conflict actually break out. Just today, President Trump said his fire and fury threat aimed at Pyongyang maybe wasn't tough enough. And Defense Secretary James Mattis has been talking about the end of the North Korean regime and the destruction of its people. So what might happen if North Korea really does fire missiles in the direction of Guam? Colonel Sam Gardner, U.S. Air Force retired, ran war games for more than 20 years at the National War College and various other military institutions. Colonel Gardner, what can the U.S. do to take out North Korea's missile launchers with conventional weapons?
Probably not too much. The ability to take out the North Korean nuclear program is limited with conventional weapons. The reason it is because North Koreans are diggers. They have tunnels all over the north. We know that their weapons are stored deep underground. The problem with that is it's very difficult to destroy a weapon when you don't know where the cave goes. Does it turn to the left? Does it turn to the right? So it would be a strike against the facilities, but not necessarily a destruction of the facilities.
I mean, we heard about bunker buster bombs throughout the war in Iraq. Would that work to go into those cave networks?
Not very well, because the problem with the tunnels is you don't know where they go. And that's why I think we heard President Trump in April gleefully talk to the president of the Philippines and say the United States has two nuclear submarines in the vicinity of Korea with tremendous firepower. And from what we have heard from the way he stated the fire and fury and from what we got from the Secretary Mattis, I have to believe that the plan is to use nuclear weapons against North Korea.
That's a fairly scary conclusion. I mean, are you saying basically there's nothing to do militarily except drop a preemptive nuclear bomb on North Korea to get rid of their nuclear program?
No, to drop bombs. It would take multiple weapons, which is why maybe Secretary Mattis said, and the destruction of your people.
I mean, I think a lot of people hope that a nuclear first strike by the U.S. is unlikely. But we are talking about President Trump, who has staked out his position, and perhaps he might feel pressure to do something militarily just for the optics. Is that a scenario you ever gamed out for the Pentagon, and what was the likely North Korean response to that?
No, what we gamed out was most of the games were before North Korea had nuclear weapons. And what one always saw was that the team playing North Korea responded the way we thought, with the artillery and with chemicals causing a million plus casualties.
So the conclusion is what? Nuclear war with North Korea, or we accept a nuclear-armed North Korea?
I think the latter is the conclusion. I would call it a checkmate, that they have checkmated the United States. And that's not necessarily bad. Stability might be allowing the situation of nuclear-armed North Korea and containment by the United States. That certainly seems to be more desirable than some of the consequences that would otherwise come.
That's more desirable, but we just had White House advisor and Trump whisperer Sebastian Gorka say the United States is no longer a superpower. We are now a hyperpower. Will they accept a checkmate with North Korea with that kind of rhetoric?
I think let me just go. The two consequences that people don't talk about very much. One of the consequences is North Korea has a very large chemical weapons program. They have huge quantities of sarin gas, which could be put onto Seoul. What's going to stop them from doing that? I don't know. Which means we're talking 3 to 4 to 5 million casualties. If our response on the North Korean nuclear program is nuclear weapons, the fallout pattern puts that fallout over Japan. And they will be dirty weapons because they will be exploded at ground level. I can't believe that that's a desirable solution for us to put radioactive fallout all over Japan. It would destroy U.S.-Japanese relations for a generation.
We're going to join you in your disbelief, Colonel, and leave it there. Thanks very much for being with us.
Certainly.
Colonel Sam Gardner, U.S. Air Force retired, ran war games for the Pentagon for more than 20 years. This is The World.
If you see him walk down the street towards you, he has all the classic autistic tics, and you'd think, whoa, I'd better stand off the sidewalk and let this guy go by, because he obviously needs the space more than I do. And yet, when you read him and sit down opposite the table from him, he will spell out these sentences letter by letter. And he's articulate. He's eloquent.
That's author David Mitchell describing a young Japanese writer named Naoki Higashida. Mitchell and his wife, K.A. Yoshida, have translated two books by Higashida, who, as we just heard, is autistic. The first title, written when Higashida was just 13 years old, became a bestseller. It's called The Reason I Jump. The second book is out now. This one is titled Fall Down 7 Times, Get Up 8. Mitchell says his wife stumbled on Higashida's writings when the couple was looking for guidance on raising their own autistic son.
He has nonverbal autism, so he's never had a conversation like this in his life. He just hasn't got that communicative app that so many of us are born with. He communicates via an alphabet grid, which is a piece of card with the QWERTY keyboard written on it, and he points to letters and builds up words and sentences that way. It's a lot harder for him than I've made it sound, but with effort and time and having to start over and over and over again, he can get paragraphs and pages and eventually whole books out.
What happens when Higashida attempts to have a conversation with one or more people? Did you witness that?
You could ask him a question and he would be unable to answer it verbally in the same way that you would be unable to jump out of a window and fly. It's not for want of trying, believe me. He'd love to do it more than any other thing. He'd love to be able to speak, but his brain is wired in such a way that he cannot do that. He can sometimes do presentations, and he attends autism symposiums where he can read a prepared text. Again, it's not easy. He sometimes needs time just to walk around the stage and look out of the window, and then has to be gently guided back to the mic by a helper or by his mum, who accompanies him to many of these things. He would read in, I suppose you could call it a classically autistic voice. It's high-pitched, it's quite screechy. He has relatively little control over modulation, so he kind of can't sound as calm and measured as you and I try to do when we speak, often unconsciously. Naoki, he can speak from the inside as someone with a direct experience at the coalface. And our son hasn't evolved that skill, so we also haven't had a conversation with our son, who's now 11, ever. Naoki is no guru. He's no kind of... He isn't saying that he has the keys to nonverbal autism, but he has some keys to his nonverbal autism, and luckily there is quite a lot of common ground.
Maybe in his latest book, Fall Down 7 Times, Get Up 8, the kinds of things you and your wife were really drawn to and the connections you were able to make between Naoki and your own son. Like, how does Naoki shed light on some of our faulty assumptions about autism in Fall Down 7 Times, Get Up 8?
For example, there's one section just called It's Raining, where he describes 12 stages that he needs to go through to register the fact that it's raining. I'd have no idea that that would be going on in anyone's mind. Sort of, we just look out the window, see the rain, think, aha, it's raining. Mm. But certainly for Naoki, it's not that simple. And what was revealing to me is just what he would like to do if he could, what he'd like to be able to achieve if his autism wasn't stopping him. And in his case, at least, it's gratitude. He would like to express gratitude to his parents for what they do for him. It's just being able to say, thanks very much. I found that really moving. And I found him informative also on how he'd like us to interact with him when he has meltdowns, when autism forces him to lose the plot a bit. And that can be quite dramatic when you see it in front of you. It's a grown man for all intents and purposes having an emotional meltdown in front of you, and he might be punching his head or biting his clothes, but he just explains what's going on in his head when that happens and how it's best for you not to try and talk him out of it or cajole him out of it or even shout at him. He explains why this is fuel on the fire, and instead just asking him to make sure he can't hurt himself or anyone else, but just to stand back and give him the time to work through it. And then he will. And I've seen this happen with my own eyes as well. 3-4 minutes later, he's fine. But he wouldn't have been fine had people sort of weighed in with verbal violence or tasers or anything like that.
Yeah. What is Naoki like as a person? This may be a difficult question, but once you take away the meltdowns and the lack of modulation in his voice, what is he like?
I really like him. I'd be honored to consider him a friend. He's, I don't know, 101 things, really. Naoki talks about how great it is to see the world, and that was really helpful for my wife and I as well. We sort of assumed that because it's easy for us, for our son to stay in his comfort zone in West Cork in Ireland, where we live, where the shopkeepers know him and the dentist knows him, and it works, and we're unlikely to run up against anything that's out of his depth. Naoki talks about how the best things in his life are actually when he does get on a plane and when he does. There's a section just because of the first, the success of The Reason I Jump, his New York publisher brought him over to do a couple of events there. And just what a horizon expanding few days that was for his. So as a result of that, we tried the same thing on our 11-year-old and we flew to London. And all the things I was afraid might happen and could happen, they didn't. I mean, they might have done, but they didn't. And when we got home from that, our son was just walking a little taller within himself.
I just have one last question, David. And Naoki says he's lucky. He's lucky to be wired the way he is. What specifically about his difference, about the way he's wired, makes him so happy, do you think?
This is not to deny the fact for a moment that life with severe nonverbal autism is much, much harder in some ways he talks about, in other ways we can't imagine, than it would be if he were neurotypical. However, for better or for worse, Naoki is an expert on autism. He can help. He can help people like me who have a kid with autism who can't express himself. He can do it. And I'm only guessing, but that must give you a sense of purpose. It's certainly not a life without meaning, is it? What do you think?
Yeah, I have to agree. Author David Mitchell and his wife K.A. Yoshida have translated Naoki Higashida's new book. It's called Fall Down 7 Times, Get Up 8. David, thank you very much.
It's my pleasure. Thanks so much.
Yeah, definitely not a life without meaning. We'll leave it there for today. The World comes to you from the Nan and Bill Harris studios here at WGBH in Boston. I'm Marco Werman, back of the mic with you tomorrow.
PRI, Public Radio International.